Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Interim Committee on Health Care and Human Services. It's Monday, September 16th, and
welcome, everyone, also to the House Interim Committee on Health Care.
All right. Would someone like to, we have some rules, and Sandy, is there any changes to committee rules?
No, Madam Chair, they are basically the same as our session, outlines our quorum and our posting requirements and our minutes, etc.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated today.
All right. Senator Cruz moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 16th, 2013. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered.
Chair Kinney-Geyer, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated 9-16-2013.
Representative Thompson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated 9-16-2013. Is there any discussion? Any objections? The motion passes and the rules are adopted.
Great. Before, I know that a number of my committee members are going to go to bill signings later on, as probably we all are, so I'm going to make some announcements now. We have to remember we get three committee bills, two personal bills. And Senator Cruz and I are going to figure out which three committee bills, because there's been more than three that have been proposed to us.
What a shock.
Yeah. So, but they can't be controversial at all. But
what's your sense of humor?
November 26th is when we have to submit to LC any possible legislation, and then the LCs will come back to us on January 3rd, and then the LCs have to be dropped in our respective clerk's office on January 21st. So I am hoping that from my perspective, every bill that comes out of the Senate is going to be easy and non-controversial.
Mine will be.
Yes. I would just like to say that Representative Greenlick, the chair of this committee, is on sabbatical in California, and he is on the phone with us today. Welcome, Representative Greenlick. And we have
on
the
mute.
Rules.
So.
Thank you very much. Happy to be there.
All right. I'd like to I bet. I would like to call Bruce Goldberg up. We're going to have an update on coordinated care organizations.
Chairs Kenny Geyer and Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, Bruce Goldberg, director of the Oregon Health Authority, here to give you a quick update as to where we are with our coordinated care organizations and the health system transformation in Medicaid. Great to see everybody. It sort of feels like first day back at school after summer vacation. Everybody looks good, well rested, but we've been busy. We now have 16 coordinated care organizations up and operational around the state. That covers every geographic area of the state. The last part of the state that was taking a little bit of time, Klamath Falls, is now up and going as a coordinated care organization. 13 of our CCOs just celebrated their one-year anniversary, so they've been at this for a year. About 95%, a little under 95% of the Oregon Health Plan population is getting their care in a coordinated care organization. The transitions have been fairly smooth. We are beginning to fold in a number of additional services into CCOs that were not either traditionally in managed Medicaid or that were not originally in the coordinated care organizations. For example, non-emergent transportation, alcohol and drug residential treatment services, and as of January, targeted case management. I think what we've learned from all of that is that each of these funding streams has a unique complexity. You know, initially there was, I think, a lot of a lot of interest in our coordinated care organizations to move as much of the funding as we could so we could coordinate more of the services. As I think we've all gotten some experience with each of those funding streams having some unique administrative complexities, some political complexities, and a variety of other issues, we're taking things a little bit slowly. Not everybody is moving all those services into their CCO at the same time. Dental care is beginning to be integrated. Dental care is beginning to be integrated. Three of our CCOs have begun to incorporate dental services as part of what they're doing, and more will be coming on board October 1. Metrics. Our CCOs are being measured on their 33 metrics. You may have seen the first metrics report that came out about 4 or 5 months ago, which details CCO performance on 33 different outcomes of healthcare. We've now had a second quarterly report, and we'll have a third quarterly report first week in November. Those results are available. They're up on the web, health.oregon.gov. People can look at CCOs, see how they're performing. We have our Transformation Center up and going. The Transformation Center, which is being funded by a federal grant to help us transform care, is encourages the widespread adoption of best practices, helps CCOs do their work. We have learning collaboratives about new payment methods, about how to integrate physical and behavioral health. We're helping to provide technical assistance to CCOs as they need it. There's a Council of Clinical Innovators being formed. There are conferences, workshops. Each of our CCOs has an innovator agent assigned to them to help learn about best practices and also to work with us to decrease bureaucracy and be a single point of contact. All that is coming up. It's a lot of work to change how care is delivered. And the Transformation Center is really set up as a way to help, in essence, make good ideas travel faster. And so that's been coming up and working. During the legislative session, there was a $30 million transformation fund that was passed to give CCOs some resources to help change how care is delivered. Just as a reminder, when we started this whole system transformation, we did it without making any large investment of resources. In fact, just the opposite. We did it at a time when we cut resources going to healthcare. And most people that undertake this type of large-scale change often make an upfront investment and then get a return on that investment. We're getting the return right now. We're certainly seeing the results of our labors. CCOs are staying within their cost targets, and indeed the pattern of how care is being delivered has changed, but we made no investment in that. And this $30 million fund is really our first statewide investment in that. We've been working with the CCOs on how to get that money to them in a way that they could get it quickly but be accountable for projects that would help change how care is being delivered and that would have results that they could each share with each other. proud to say that the first first wave to 8 CCOs is going out this month. The projects that they're working on, or we have one CCO looking at changing care for a group of people who utilize the most healthcare services. Another CCO is looking at how to better engage clients in personal responsibility for care. Another is looking at some help for better using primary care homes. A fourth is looking at alternative payment methods for, particularly for social supports, the kinds of things that have historically not been paid for as part of medical billing. So a lot of work's going on. I think it's been moving forward in really great fashion. I continue to worry, one, about expectations, that we're looking to change decades and decades of practice and of care, and that takes time. And we live in an environment where I think we all expect instantaneous results. And so I get worried about the expectations. I think we're on pace. Our CCOs are paying a lot of attention to the metrics. They're paying a lot of attention to staying within their costs. And the last thing I want to touch on is when we started this health system transformation, we really looked at a couple of things. One, we looked at changing how care is delivered. We also did some work collectively with the legislature on the medical legal climate. Those are sort of two pieces of this three-legged stool that we really think needs to be addressed to lower healthcare costs. The third one has been individual responsibility, personal responsibility. A lot of what we've been doing has been geared at getting the provision of care to change and about changing the medical legal climate. We have just begun work on that third leg of the stool. There is a task force on individual responsibility. Representative Kenny Geyer and Representative Thompson are part of that, and Senators Boquist and Johnson, as well as seven individuals. They've met for the first time. They're on a very, very aggressive timeline, as everything we do in healthcare, coming back with recommendations late November, December, that could potentially get turned into legislation for the February session. So that's up and going. And then the last thing I will just touch on, because I was asked to, was to provide a quick update on House Bill 2020. This is a bill that really is about the credentialing of behavioral health practitioners around the state. We've been working with stakeholders to develop the appropriate list for a work group to meet as specified by the bill. The invitations for that work group should go out in the next week or two. Meetings are scheduled for October, and we fully anticipate that we will have work on the rules by January 1 as specified in the bill. So didn't get going right at the end of session in July, but I think we're getting things up and on track. So with that, let me stop and take any questions.
I just have two more questions. One is on Senate Bill 604. That's the credentialing database. Could you just comment where we are on that one?
Yes.
And what one,
and,
Senator?
And 569, the telemedicine one.
And 569, the telemedicine. Sorry.
Okay. No.
I usually shoot to Bill or Bruce to let him know, but sorry.
No, it's okay. 604, I am very intimately involved with. We have put together a stakeholder advisory group. The invitations to that went out last week. That group will start meeting and helping to advise us on putting out the initial RFP for a system to be able to streamline credentialing. So the work is moving forward on that. I must admit, Senator Steiner Hayward, that I will need to get back to you on 569. I don't have that at the top of my head, but I will get a progress report back to Sandy to get to everybody on the committee.
And then one other thing before you leave. I had asked you about CCOs. We still use the prioritized lists, and CCOs are not required to cover things that are below the line, but they this is, I think, my interpretation of what you said to me, but they have flexibility to pay for them if they so desire. Could you put that on the record?
Yes. We, Senator Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, we continue to use the prioritized list of health services, and that's used for two reasons. The prioritized list, in essence, sets the minimum benefit package for Medicaid, and it provides the funding level for the health plan. So we use the list to provide the funding that goes to the CCOs. We also use the prioritized list as a way of creating what are best practices for evidence-based care. Through that prioritized list, there are guidelines done by the Health Evidence Review Commission to be able to establish those. Once that's established, however, CCOs are free, as they have been, if they so desire, to pay for things that are below the line, should they desire to, but they are not required to do that.
Thank you.
Representative Thompson?
You mentioned alternative support. I'm still getting complaints that the CCOs are not contracting with chiropractors and naturopaths. I think we've been through that for like 2 years or something. You know the question.
Yes.
Any update on when that's going to happen or where we're going with that?
Representative Thompson, members of the committee, couple of updates. As I think you know, we have a process in place now in rule for a way to handle any complaints about providers who feel they've been discriminated against. To my knowledge, last time I checked, about 2 months ago, there was one complaint, and that was being worked through. I will check back and see if there have been any more. I've met with a group of alternative medical providers, and we have just established an advisory group that will meet next month. The invitation, the group's been formed. It's a group that is has a number of two chiropractors, two naturopaths, two acupuncturists, two midwives, several of the medical directors from the CCOs and others, and it's an advisory group to us as an agency to actually have a forum to sit down and work through some of these issues, be able to talk freely about what some of the concerns are, share best practices. So I think and I hope that will help, and we take it a step at a time.
Lovely.
Dr. Goldberg, I'd like to hear just a little bit more. You talk about on pace, and I appreciate the work that the CCOs are doing and have done, and I think they've done great work. And the on pace is staying within their costs, and I understand what bending the curve. But I'm more interested, frankly, when you say on pace, to what besides that the CCOs are gearing towards or able to accomplish, because I'm still concerned about the total cost, regardless of how much we bend the curve, about even if we can bend it, what we can do, what the CCOs can do in that other area, because costs are still going up.
Chairs Kenny Geyer, Mona Sanderson, Rep. Lively, members of the committee. Healthcare costs are continuing to go up, and what we have tried to do with our coordinated care organizations has been to keep that growth within what's sustainable, so that it is in line with how state revenues will grow, how consumer price index is looking to grow, gross domestic and gross state product out into the future. We had been up at 5, 6, 7% in Medicaid. We now are looking at this past year, we've got it down to 4.4%, and this coming year we'll be at 3.4%. That's where we're pegged at staying. And I think what we need to do is demonstrate that we have gotten to that lower cost by fundamentally changing how care is delivered. Because it's easy to lower costs by simply, one, denying care, or two, just paying less for it. And what we've done in the CCOs and actually in these reports start to look at both not just the costs but the utilization patterns so that we can demonstrate that we are changing how care is being delivered and getting rid of some of the wasteful and inefficient care. So we've seen over the last year a decline in emergency department utilization in the Oregon Health Plan for the first time in a while. And it's been for the kinds of emergencies that you would want to see decline. The less complex visits, you obviously don't want to see. I mean, we ultimately like to see no one ending up with a heart attack or a motor vehicle accident, but for the kinds of self-limited problems that could either be prevented with good primary care or should get seen with good primary care. So we're seeing that change start to happen, and I think that's what we want to see. The more that we can see a shift to more primary care, less need for care for people with chronic illnesses. 20% of people generate about 80% of the costs, and that's where a lot of the focus is.
Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you very much. Dr. Goldberg, I'm not entirely sure if this is a question for you or Mr. King, so I'll ask and then you guys can decide.
Okay.
And it actually relates well to the answer you just gave to Representative Lively. I know you've been in some conversations with people in the primary care community about issues around continuity of care and assignment of people in CCOs to individual primary care providers.
Yep.
Obviously, especially for these people with complex chronic problems, that's critically important because a disruption of continuity of care is going to be bad, to use a technical term.
Yeah.
and I'm wondering where we stand with that. And I don't know if it's an issue of the exchange for people who are coming on, newly coming on, or if it's an issue for people who are currently in OHP and are being assigned to CCOs. And if you could just update us on that, I'd be grateful.
Sure. Chairs, Senator Steiner Hayward, members of the committee. I think Rocky can touch a little. I think it's for both of us. And let me talk a little bit about this from the perspective of OHP and a little bit about the exchange, and then I think Rocky can talk about it as well when he comes up. Certainly, continuity of care is key. One thing we've been able to work on the Medicaid side over the just the last few days has been an opportunity whereby when there's a group of people who qualify for the health plan now based on qualifying for food stamps. It's called fast track eligibility. They don't, because they've qualified for a federal program by income, if they meet the income level for OHP, they don't need to apply. They can simply be enrolled if they so desire. We're sending out a letter to those people, and we're only asking two questions on it. Well, three. One is, would you like to be involved to sign up for the health plan? And they need to affirm. We're asking them if who their primary care provider is, so that we can get that information to the CCOs. And then lastly is where there's a choice of CCO, they get a choice of CCO. And we're also working with CCOs on helping to assign people based on primary care choice.
ultimately, what I think we'd like to do, both on the Medicaid side as well as on the exchange side, is to be able to have, when people come onto the website and sign up for care, that they'll be able to see where their, who, if their primary care provider is part of a particular health plan or CCO, and be able to sign up for that. Ultimately, that's where we want to go. We are not going to be there over the next 6 months. We've been looking at being able to right now just get people choice of plan, and the provider directory function is going to take a little bit more time and work to develop, but that's ultimately where we want to be.
Thank you very much.
No further questions?
Quick question for you also. I had the fortune of being on a conference call with you on the day that the Oregonian came out with the article about the national group's concern about tort reform and whether that was going to hide what doctors were doing, and you addressed that at the time. I wonder if you could share that with everyone and tell us if there are any updates to that as well.
Sure. Chair Ken Geyer, members of the committee, the question was one of whether or not our new Med-Mal reforms were in some way going to shield providers who had indeed committed errors. And nothing further since we talked, but what we had talked about on the phone call for everybody is a couple of things. We are working with the Patient Safety Committee that is going to be responsible for implementing the administrative procedures, and are going to be looking at ways we can work through the safety issues involved. And I think recently have reached out to try and talk with some of these national organizations. It was the first that we had heard of these concerns, and we're going to try and work through them. It's never been the intent to shield anybody from scrutiny. In fact, just the opposite. The whole point of these reforms was to promote safety, and that a lot of hard work was done on this, and a lot of work was done to balance the issues around safety, and we're plan on continuing to work towards that. I know Senator Cruz, I know you were an important part of all that.
Yeah, if I could.
Please.
Just for the record, when we're talking about these informal conversations, it was never envisioned from our perspective that would be a red flag for anybody, and it shouldn't be. Obviously, if the procedure goes beyond informal and they're getting into more formal sorts of things outside of that cloistered environment, then everything's fair game. But if this is designed as a gotcha, then we aren't going to get anywhere with it. And we considered that at the very beginning, and we were all very clear that this was a way to make sure that people had satisfaction in whatever happened. And if the serious things are still going to end up doing what the serious things always do. But if indeed it appears that some people think that we are trying to hide the peat, we clearly are not, and if they think that they can undo that, we'll come back at it and make sure they can't.
Representative Greenlick, do you have any questions before we let Dr. Goldberg go?
Yes, Bruce, can you tell me what's going on with the future public health process?
Yes, I can. I'm glad I'm 2 for 3 being asked about bills. I can even tell you what the name of that bill was, House Bill 2348. We're in the middle of planning for the some people that need to be appointed. I need to appoint some people. The governor needs to appoint some people. We hope to get those appointments made in the next few weeks. I know that the legislators have been appointed, but we're also starting to work on a work plan for the group, so hoping that once we can get those appointments out, we can get that group up and going and on track.
Bruce, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Yes. Senator Cruz, the last question. We need to move.
Bruce, I was going to stay quiet, but Representative Kenny Geyer got me going there. So what's going on at the federal level?
I asked
the question quite simply because, there are some actions or inactions that could happen over the next few weeks that could have significant impacts on what we are doing. I mean, are you getting any sort of read at this point? I guess primarily the money commitment that the feds gave us, if Congress actually ever got around to passing a budget, which they haven't done in 5 years, that might be in jeopardy, but could it be jeopardized by the structure of the continuing resolution?
Chairs Mona Sanderson and Kenny Geyer, Senator Cruz, a couple things. One, we don't anticipate that our commitment from the feds would in any way be impacted by a continuing resolution, because what that continuing resolution does is it continues the funding as it currently is.
And not necessarily. But go ahead.
Certainly. So we don't anticipate a continuing resolution would. If there was any kind of massive changes in the federal budget could affect us. Having said that, I think you see it on TV every day, as do we. There's still a lot of partisan bickering about federal health reform. I think that certainly from the administration, there's been a strong commitment for this continuing, and from what we can see is that, quite frankly, there have been greater and greater flexibilities granted to more and more states to have them move forward with federal reform. So I would not, quite frankly, anticipate in any way the federal government reneging on what they've done. If anything, what we see when I look around and look at other states is a continuing effort to get more and more states on board with moving forward. So I see the funding continuing, and having said that, we rely on a lot of federal funding, and what happens in Washington will affect us, but I don't think I have a better crystal ball than you do.
Madam Chair, I guess part of the point is, and you kind of touched on it, Bruce, is that we may be entering a period of time where waivers may be easier than they used to be to achieve, and so we can start looking at maybe getting a little further outside the box on some things.
Senator Cruz, I would agree for exactly that reason. I think that there is greater and greater flexibility. So I actually see us not being in jeopardy, but actually perhaps having some additional opportunity, not so much for dollars, but for additional flexibilities. That's correct.
Thank you, Dr. Goldberg, very much. Rocky King, he's going to update us on Cover Oregon, our insurance exchange. And while he's getting up there, I had the opportunity on last Thursday to go and do a trial run on going online and seeing how the whole process is, and I'm very, very impressed. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the executive director for Cover Oregon, and with me is Amy Favre, who is the chief of communications and outreach and marketing and has been sitting next to me for 2 years as we walk through this process. So I'm very happy to be here today. I just want to remind you that 2 years ago, when the legislation became effective, October, I think, of 2011, that's been 2 years, and my first appearance before you as the official executive director, I said that one of the quotes I'd heard I found interesting, and that is that 50% of the people were disappointed and did not want us to exist. The other 50% of the people were disappointed because we weren't going to be what they wanted us to be. And I'm here to report to you, after 2 years, we haven't moved that needle. I've still got 50% on each side. But I want to remind us why we were here. First of all, more than 500,000 Oregonians are uninsured. We have big enrollment goals between the public and private sectors, with hopefully over 400,000 that will be eligible for tax credits or be eligible for Medicaid or other financial help. And the ACA, which makes health care more accessible to more Oregonians and hopefully more affordable because of the tax credits and the expansion of Medicaid. And then finally, because we in Oregon decided to do it by Oregonians for Oregonians. 35 states have elected to let the federal government do it. 15 states elected to really do it themselves. And I think that's important, because when we're down in Coos Bay last week, or Medford next week, or over in Bend, or training agents, which I'll talk about, or community partners, these are things that we're doing throughout Oregon that in those 35 states where the feds are, they're not doing. They're basically working from Washington, D.C. The call center for Oregon is in Oregon. The call center for many states is in Washington, D.C. or Virginia. So we're really proud that the legislature and the governor chose to take this effort on, and we've done the best we can. We'll try to go through this to show you what's been going on. Our enrollment goals are pretty simple, about 217,000 at the end of the first year. About 57,000 of those are for the group market, 160 for the individual. That's our mid-level objective. If you remember, I came to you 2 years ago and gave you a low, medium, and high. We're still shooting for the high. I went 280 to 300,000. But that mid, I'll be happy with, and the low is really a break even, so we don't want to go below that. We hope between Bruce's programs at OHA and this that we'll bring the uninsurance rate down to about 5 or 6% by 2016. So that's pretty exciting. We've never been there in long as I've lived in Oregon. We've been busy building an online marketplace. We got over 500 to 750,000 lines of code. We've been user testing. Both some of the legislators have been coming up and going through the system, but a lot of business folks and just general folks just been coming in and really looking at our system. We've trained over 1,600 agents. I have another 400 agents to train in the next month and a half. We've trained about 1,200 community partners, representing about 200 to 250 organizations throughout the state. We envision another 300 to 400 that will be trained over the next month. We've launched an ad campaign. It is not directed, if you've heard it, heard our songs, it's not directed at the 50-year-old sitting there. We're going after the young and healthy, which is really, and you'll hear about this later when I talk about the things that keep me up, it's really important we get that young and healthy into these markets, whether it's the exchange or the outside the market, because those are the ones that kind of balance off some of those risks. We've opened a call center. You can now call 1-855-COVER-OR, and we have customer service staff that are there to help you with general questions. Beginning October 1st, they'll be working with agents, community partners, and the general population to really help them navigate our website. As you know, the finalized rates through the Oregon Insurance Division, you probably read a lot of the press on that. Oregon has been very lucky. Our rates are considerably lower than what any of us, I think, thought. And compared to the rest of the nation, we can really hold our heads high. And I think part of that is just the competition that you're going to see when you look at the number of carriers involved. You go to state of Washington, and they initially had three individual market carriers. They've been fighting to try to bring that to six. They think they got it up there now to six. For their small employer program, two counties, one carrier. And you'll see in ours, we have much more involvement in the part of the industry, which adds to some of that competition. We've made over 100 community presentations. We've also created evaluation metrics. You'll start seeing stuff coming out of us very early in terms of who's applying, how long are they staying, what's their age, what kind of benefit plans, what's the cost. A lot of the metrics that we'll be looking at initially. The next slide shows you those 11 individual market carriers that are participating. A lot of people ask about the CCOs. I want to point out two CCOs, Atrio and Trillium, are there as a part of those 11. Plus, you've got Pacific Source, Providence, Moda, Kaiser, a variety of the carriers that are a part of CCOs. So we think we're beginning that alignment, although it's really a two-year vision that we're going to be working on to try to integrate not the CCOs, but the models and the lessons that the CCOs learn into the commercial market. They're doing that in PEB with this current RFP, and we'll be really working closely with PEB and OHA as we build in some of those models into our plans also. In the public programs, we have both Medicaid and Healthy Kids that will be able to be accessed through the exchange. And then on the small group side, we have 8 carriers. Again, compare this to our brothers to the north, our sisters. They have 1 carrier, 2 counties. We have 8 carriers that are participating in the small group market. This is going to give small employers and their employees a lot of choices. And I want to pause here because, I know there's a lot of people get mad at insurance companies, and I do too, but they have really taken a step forward. They are participating in Oregon's in exchange. This is unlike most areas of the country. Most states will have 3 or 4 carriers participating. We probably are on the top 3 or 4 states in terms of carrier participation. In terms of dental carriers, as you probably know, you can purchase a standalone dental plan, whether you're in the individual or the small group market. And we have a number of carriers that have elected to participate in Oregon's exchange. Plan choices?
While you're on dental, I've had an issue brought to me that they're very upset about OHSU dental not participating or being considered a DCO. I'm not quite sure the terminology, because there are patients that are being assigned to CCOs that had been getting their dental care from, say, a pediatric specialist, et cetera, and now they are unable to do that. Have you heard that issue at all?
Chair Morris Anderson, I have not heard that issue. Is that a Medicaid?
I think it's a Medicaid, okay. So I'll address that with Bruce another time. Thank you.
Now, OHSU as an entity did not elect to offer a standalone plan through the exchange, but that was their decision. Yeah. Plan choices, we have 102 plans that will be available in the individual market. Remember, people can sort by geography, price, quality grades, whether they want an HMO or a PPO plan, a variety of ways to sort and bring that down. And there's really only a couple counties where you have basically the full expansion of plans that are offered. Clackamas County has more plans being offered in the individual market than any other county, even more than Multnomah. But in every part of the state, we have at least 2 carriers that are offering multiple plans, so we're happy with that. Number of plans in the small group market is 72, and to the best of our knowledge right now, about 25 of those plans that are being offered will qualify for HSA, qualified health plans, which is important for some of the small employer plans where they may want to make a contribution to an HSA where they can then use pre-tax dollars for some of the co-pays and the deductibles. Okay, we're into some of the outreach campaign. And first of all of our outreach and marketing is really based, I think the central thing is on research. We did a lot of focus groups. We did a lot of talking with different groups to really find out what resonates, what are the terms. And that has led to, a paid media campaign, an earned media campaign. We have online outreach. If you've ever gone to our website or from Google, for example, you'll never lose our little logo. It's always up there. We're doing statewide grassroots with our partners. I'll talk about that in a minute. We have a lot of marketing materials. One of the things we will share with you at the end here is we have a legislative toolkit, and you can get access through coveroregonstore.com. that right?
Yep.
Where you can go on and order as much as you want. If you're an agent, you can actually get it personalized with your name of your firm and your phone numbers and personal contact information. A lot of marketing materials, and as we said, we've been doing a lot of community meetings. To reach a diverse population, all of our materials are being translated into 7 languages, and it's just not a question. Actually, they've been translated. They're now out with our community partners. You know, it's one thing to do a translation, and then the second is to really get it out there so that the actual people can take a look at it and see if that we really use the right way of phrasing some of the words. It's just not a simple question of changing one word to a different language. It's really trying to make them culturally specific and appropriate also. We have announced just recently 31 grants for outreach and enrollment that were awarded. This is throughout the state. The majority of those are really, I think almost all of them, are focused on really the underserved, the difficult-to-reach populations. We found out with Healthy Kids and OHA's very successful program of outreach that getting those people with the boots on the ground is how to get to some of those populations. So we've done that. We have grants now that are being reviewed and be announced shortly with 10 business organizations. 10 business organizations so that we can do outreach with business groups also. I can give an example, and I don't know if they've even applied for a grant, but Steve McCoy Restaurant Association, you know, they've got over 100,000 employees. The majority of those are uninsured. How can we work with those associations to make sure that we get the words both to the employee and or the employer about some of the opportunities that are available? We'll be starting some additional rounds of community grants, and these will primarily be for those that want to either do outreach only or enrollment only. The first was outreach and enrollment, so now we're kind of looking at maybe people want to do a little bit less, and we're going to be looking at grants there. We'll be starting in October a pretty expansive Spanish language ad campaign. So depends whether you watch those channels or read the newspapers, you'll see that coming. We'll have we do have assistance in multiple languages right now at our call center, and we're developing culturally relevant materials for tribes. And part of our grants that are not included up there, also the tribal grants that we've made, and we've tried to identify resources in every with every tribe that we'll be working with to make sure that they get the right information and from the right people. You'll be able to search for agents and community partners and tribes by geography and language. Timeline, and I'll talk about our stage enrollment in a minute, but October 1st enrollment begins. December 15th is a key date for question?
Yes, can you answer
Madam Chair? Representative Harker?
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I've had some questions, some pointed questions from people outside the building about the amount of money being spent on the outreach, which I see the value of the outreach, but what can I say to those? Maybe they're not quite critics, but they're skeptics in terms of the amount that was budgeted for it, what's being spent, et cetera.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Harker, the federal government kind of decided on a per-enrollment basis what every state gets. So we have basically on a per-enrollment basis pretty much the same as California and some of those other states. This is a tough population to get to. These aren't folks that are just knocking on the door that have been waiting to get insurance. These are very often the underserved, the people that, you know, the young and healthy. How do you convince the young and healthy to come into the system? And the outreach grant really is for this first year and a half or first 2 years, and then we're going to have to scale that back. This is a direction that the administration gave all the states is go out and try to enroll as many of these folks as you can.
Okay, but we have a federal grant that is covering so far all of the costs of the outreach?
100% of our costs. Outreach, IT development, staff salaries, customer service, up through the end of 2014 is paid for by the federal government. Starting January 1, 2015, we have to be self-sustaining, so we'll have to pay for our own way for all costs. Federal government is pulling back all those funds at that point.
Thank you.
So back to the timeline. January 1, coverage begins. That's the first time you can go through the exchange and actually enroll in that coverage. But people have in the individual market until March 31st to sign up. In Medicaid, open enrollment is all year. And in the small group plans, enrollment is all year. But for individual markets, it's only through March 31 unless you have a specific occurrence. What's it called? What am I looking
for?
Qualifying event. Thank you. Get married, have a child, work a death in the family, whatever that may be, before you can then come in after March 31st or look at changing your coverage after that date. This is why, you know, a lot of people I know are focused on October 1, but we do have some time. We've got basically 6 months to get as many folks enrolled as we can. We want to get as many in before January 1 because that's when coverage starts, but there's nothing magic about coming in October 1 versus November 1 in terms of when that coverage begins. So keep calm, go live. So I'm going to talk about some of our challenges and some of our problems here. So first of all, about two months ago, really looking at where we are, we're doing a four-year project in 2 years. I will tell you, if I could take 6 months off and just go into a room and test, I would do that today. The reason I can't do that is because that means somebody who is eligible for coverage on January 1 can't get it. So I have had to push to this date of October 1st as fast as we can. But there are going to be problems. So one of the ways we've decided to mitigate that, because our focus is the customer experience, is how can we work out the bugs and kind of have the pros going through the system with us, not just the individual testers, but really a group of folks, the community partners and the agents. And the best way to do that is have this system really first open up just to them. So they can sit down with their clients, or new clients or old clients, and go through that process. And when they find a problem, they can call that customer service center. The customer service center calls up to our triage team who looks at that problem. Is it something we can fix now? Is it something we can fix tonight? And we really begin developing a list of all the bugs. Now, let me tell you an example of one that just happened Friday in Maryland, because I was talking to the director. Through their user testing, they discovered that an individual family of five, an error came up on their rate for several of the plans, not all of the plans. Now, for a family of four, a family of six, the rate was right. And we really are going to get now, when you look at that 500 to 750,000 lines of code and all the information that comes in, we want to make this experience for the customer as best we can. So we just said for the first 2 weeks, go through an agent, go through a community partner. That's the best way for us to really handle this. If we have to bring the system down at 3 o'clock on the 2nd of October, we can communicate with those folks who can then work with their clients to do that. So we just thought it was really prudent, because our focus is the customer, to make sure that we do this the best way we can. I'm going to remind, and Amy actually tells this story, Google, when they first came out with their email, they didn't just open up Google email. They invited people to open up. And if you weren't invited, you couldn't open up. If you wanted Google Glass, they invited 1,500. They didn't make it available to everybody. Apple with their new operating system. There is a group of developers who have been using an operating system for 6 months. So we've just tried to follow that agency standard that way. So later in October, all Oregonians will be able to apply online by themselves. I can't tell you a date. I'm hoping by the 15th. If it's we don't have a lot of problems, we'll make it earlier. If we have more problems than we thought, we could postpone that. I do have some key decisions to make. Next week, I'll make it on the small employer program, SHOP. And I'm saying that because we really are running through the final testing of that. And if I don't have the quoting system so that it is at the level or standard that I want it to be at, then I'm going to throw up my hand and say, wait a week, wait 2 weeks, get it right before we go live. That's not, again, not unusual and industry standard. And I'll also make the decision of when to go wider, probably after the first week of October when we see what kind of problems are there. This is standard approach in most of the industry. It's a necessary approach when we're doing a two-year our four-year project in 2 years. I should also say a whole bunch of states, including the federal government, have really scaled back their scope. Oregon is the only one that is doing Medicaid, healthy kids, four options under the small employer program, plus commercial individual, with the number of plans that we have. So we really have a much more complicated system than most states. Maryland has already put off their shop exchange. You know, Washington said one option in their small employer. California is not doing Medicaid enrollment. They're sending information to the county to enroll in Medicaid. So every state is a little bit different. So let's see what else I got on this one. Go live team will go that. Okay. So what can customers expect on October 1? Go to our website. They'll be able to go on there, browse. They'll be able to look at plans, look at rates, but they will not, unless they're with an agent or a community partner, be able to go forward. So there's a kind of a side door that community partners and agents can use to log in that really opens up the system to the broader functions that we're going to provide. They'll still be able to browse and still be able to look and see what's available. They just will not be able to purchase.
Rocky, quick question.
Yep.
Are these agents and community groups throughout the entire state?
Yes, Madam Chair, they are throughout the state. It's the community partners. They're in every county. They're in every county, and agents are also. Although, admittedly, when you get to Eastern Oregon, they're not next door to you. You know, it's just the reality of the geography. But yes, we have agents throughout the state. I also want to prepare everybody that there's going to be long wait times when you call us on October 1. I've got 160 staff. We'll be there answering phones. If I had 1,000 staff, I probably still could not answer the phones on day one. And to keep that admin cost down, we've got queues. We've got the ability for people to set up appointments via messaging. But just be prepared that there is no way you can ever meet the demand if everybody tries to come through that front door on day one. All of our community partners will be setting up appointments with folks, and depending on how many people call, it may take some time for an agent or a community partner to be able to sit down with folks, but we will get to them. So here's the homepage. Those who have gone through the system have seen it. Individuals and families, employers and employees, and up in the top is find an agent or community partner. And this will be modified a little bit for our opening because it's a little bit more prominent that this is a browse site and that really we encourage you to find a community partner or an agent. We'll have in there a searchable database. This is an early version. It's going to be modified a little bit. But if you have a agent whose name is Rick in Bend, you can type in Rick, and it will bring up every Rick in Oregon, unless you put your town or zip code in there. But you can search by first name, last name, the organization, the city, the county, the zip, language, and it'll be able to bring up. You'll see the next page. It'll look like this, the search results for anybody who comes to our website. So people will be able to access and be able to contact folks that are in their local communities based on the search criteria that they have. So now we're going to get into some of the challenges. IT update, our production servers are up and running. Insurance plans and details have been loaded into the system. We've established the carrier accounts. We've established the agent and community partner accounts. They're actually finishing those up, I think, today and tomorrow. We're doing internal system live testing. And something that doesn't mean much probably to you folks, but last week we had a contingent of federal folks that came out and looked at for 3 days every aspect of our business, from community partner program to contingency plans to the IT, and they informed us when they walked out at the end of 3 days with smiles on their face that it's a thumbs up. We passed the federal readiness review, so we're really pleased that to have that from them. Now that said, because I know all the problems that we still, challenges we still have, it didn't mean much to me. I didn't celebrate that night. We just kind of regrouped and said, now what do we got to do to make sure that we make this work? So here are the The next two slides really, or three slides, really talk about some of the challenges, and I'll get to some of the specific. We still don't have federal hub authority to connect. We still have to, we have until the 20th to finish, 20th of this month, which is this week, I believe, to finish our testing with the feds, with Homeland Security, HHS, IRS, to make sure that all of our testing is complete with them. We haven't finished all of the carrier interface testing. The example is that's why the SHOP delay, the small employer program delay, is still up in the air. If I can't test it and validate the information that an employer gets back a correct rate, I will not go forward. It's still a challenge. We continue to test the portal. I'll talk about in more detail the ongoing technology challenges. But one of the things that we have are a lot of contingency plans. We have several hundred, 50 of which are priority one contingency plans, and we're continue to work on those. We have a situation room, triage team, contingency plans. We have morning, afternoon, and evening debriefs on open lines with our partners. We'll have on-the-ground partners reporting issues and problems with us when we go live. We have contractors that will be on site 24/7 to help us resolve things. There's a picture up there. Apologies to my Republican friends. That happens to be the situation room for the president. I put that up there because he actually had a conversation with us about 3 weeks ago, and down at the end there's a screen, and Tris De La Rosa, my chief of operations, I was not there, was on the line with the 14 or 12, I think, states were had their little pictures up there, and the president went around each state and was asking them how things were going. And I love the story. So they asked the first state, IT, second state, IT, third state, IT. Got to Tris. Tris says, "Well, Mr. President, our problem is parking." Pause, and she says, "Yes, Mr. President." She says, "We have 96 spaces at our office, and we have 150 people showing up to work every day." Mm-hmm. So the president says, "Tris, I can't do anything about your parking, but if you have any other problems, come up and give me a call." So then she went on and talked about the IT challenge. But we have a room up there. Our community partners, a representative from every part of our agency, if something happens with the system, Amy's got a person sitting in there that takes the communication, goes forward. We've got our customer service folks, so that word gets out to 160 of folks. We got carriers that are participating in that. We're really prepared, hopefully, for nothing. I'm hoping nothing happens, but we know it's going to. So we're getting ready for that. What keeps me up at night? These are the things I shared with you. I'll give you the general things. Again, the scope, bigger than any other state. 13,000 pages of regulations. Not all the regulations have been written yet. I am just absolutely scared to death because we have not prudently been able to give this system enough testing, both in the system user as well as performance testing. I'm not going to lie to you there. This is not going to be necessarily the most beautiful implementation. We're not alone. That doesn't give me any solace, but we'll do the best we can to make this work for Oregonians. Finally, if you build it, will they come? You know, you can have the greatest system in the world and all this, but if these folks don't come in the door, then you close up shop, because there's just no money to run this unless you get the kind of enrollments that we're looking for. Specifically, the technology challenges. Bruce is still here. Medicaid and commercial coverage integration. It's taking information through the eligibility and plan enrollment process and getting that into OHA, and we've got...
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I know that Representative Greenlick has a question, and sure. I'm not sure if it was for the last slide. So, okay. Representative Greenlick, would you like to ask your question?
Yes, thank you very much. Rocky, it was around your anxiety statement. Let's say on November 1st there are two options. You look around and you say, things are pretty much okay. Or the other option is, things seem all screwed up. Could you assign probabilities to those two right now?
Yeah. 90-10, but I won't tell you which way it
is. Fair enough. I didn't ask you which way.
I envision, Representative Gutenlich, I envision that there are going to be problems. I'm planning sometime in the first day, sometime in the second day, to take the system down to fix something. I'm sure that's going to happen. We're going to communicate that. And the reason I'm going to do that is I don't want somebody to have an eligibility determination wrong. I don't want somebody to pick a plan based on a premium that's wrong. If I see that and I can't correct it, then I've told my staff, the prudent thing to do is pull back, close it down, get messages out to our stakeholders. We're holding back until we fix these problems. I'm just hoping they're limited. But until I actually go through that, it'll be hard to know. We have 10 hours of going through that system plan tomorrow. I think it goes to 10 or 11 at night with a whole bunch of us to really kind of narrow down kind of where we think some of those risks are and to try to focus that last week and a half where those risks are the greatest.
Well, that's why I was asking about November 1st. I'm sure you're going to have lots of screw-up in the first month. That's inevitable.
And Representative Green, like November 1st would really concern me because then we start squeezing into time to really get people enrolled and engaged. But hopefully at the October, do we have legislative days? Not in October. They come in November. Hopefully when I come in November, I'm going before Jay Clement. I'll be back in front of these committees. I'll be able to give you a really detailed kind of what happened and what our plans are. So getting...
And I may as well put this in here while we're on questions. I'm getting calls from employers who are picking up somewhere that they're supposed to give employees a letter by October 1st under penalty of $100 a day fine. No one seems to know what's supposed to be in that letter.
Madam Chair, Representative Thompson, there is a federal, part of the ACA requires employers to notify their employees of the existence of, quote-unquote, the exchange, a marketplace. I don't believe there's a penalty. And there are, however, what do they call that, sample notification.
Well, I can get that from you. That's
on our website, and we'll get that for you.
Okay.
We are not responsible for implementing that portion, but I will tell you that the agents throughout the state know about that and have been working with the small employers. But we've got sample documents that we can provide you.
I'll get that.
Technology challenges, Medicaid, commercial coverage integration. I talked about the SHOP. It's the GET quoting system. It's going back and getting the right quotes to the right people when they do multiple plan choices with an employer group. Provider directories, Bruce talked about that. We have a searchable provider directory day one. The difference is that it will be either automated or a PDF. We're working to get the automated one up there where you can just type it in and it comes up who offers what plans have that provider. If we can't do the valid, and it all has to do with validation, to making sure the information is correct. If that won't be done by the 1st, we've already implemented a contingency where we'll have a link to a PDF for every carrier. You can look up the provider via the PDF. So that's one where we've actually implemented the contingency, even though we haven't finalized whether we're going to go forward with that. Federal interfaces, again, I said we haven't finalized those until the 20th of this month. Carrier enrollment reporting, we've delayed actually telling the carriers who is enrolled in terms of providing them all of the information, because again, I haven't done end-to-end testing on that data to ensure when I tell a carrier, here's the name, addresses, social security numbers, or whatever it may be of everybody enrolled, that all of that's correct. I have to run through a testing scheme that really validates that the information I'm giving them is correct, and we haven't done that yet. Some of the financial reconciliation will not be done until December 1, and again, just the deferred scope, the things that we're not doing on October 1, that always continues to be a challenge for us, but we're going to continue to move forward. Finally, I think the last slide is we've got a legislator toolkit that we provided you and your staff, provided a great deal of information. CoverOregon.com, online calculator, fact sheets, meetings and events, email. You can go to CoverOregonStore.com and order free materials. It's on-demand printing. You want 20 copies of this, it prints it out and mails it out to you. So you have to wait and call somebody on the phone. We're on Facebook and Twitter. I think the legislator toolkit will be really helpful to you and your staff. We've provided you with a variety of direct phone numbers for people when you've got a problem, a real issue with one of your constituents, as well as some general numbers that you can refer people to. So we're really trying to make sure that the communication that you have with your folks as well as with us is clear. I think that's about it. Okay. So that's kind of a quick overview. We'll do the best we can, folks. That's all we're... But it'll...
Rocky, could you... I assume... Is that me, Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Could you explain the federal interfaces in a little bit more detail, like exactly what information is being shared with who and why?
Madam Chair, Representative Conger, I probably am not the best one. I know, and I'll check. Matt, eight? Eight. We'll just say eight. I think we have eight interfaces with the feds. It may be more than that. You know, IRS, Homeland Security. So we've got to check out, for example, when somebody says that here's my Social Security number, is that in fact who that person is? Is that a valid Social Security number? We have the ability to do that. When somebody says my income is going or was this or is going to be this, we have the ability to go look at. We don't actually see it, but it goes back and it takes the income that was filed on the last tax return, puts that into the thing and says, is the figure they put in 10% more or 10% less than what they reported a couple years ago? And we don't see that, but it'll flag it and say, whoops, it looks like you're not making as much money. Are you sure that's correct? There's that. There's a variety of interfaces, and I will have to... I've got like 43 interfaces, and I don't have them all memorized. I'm sorry.
Well, I would. It's okay that you don't have them all memorized. Yeah. I don't have enough fingers and toes to count the 43. It's just maybe a little bit alarming not to know what information is being provided, who's getting it, and what's being done with it. You know, we're talking about people's health information, for example, or as you pointed out, income information.
Yeah.
And as I try to envision the enormous amount of track between here and 43 different sources and uses of my information, I think, gosh, I wonder if I really want all that out there. Yeah. Another quick question, if I may, Madam Chair. Could you just tell me, I heard the conversation in response to Rep. Thompson's question about small business employee notice. And I know that's not being driven by Cover Oregon, but just out of curiosity, what's the point of that?
Yeah, Madam Chairs and Representative Congress, so let me take the first question first. No health information is collected on our website, one. Number two, the IRS and security folks and the federal government have been on site at our place looking at our security systems, and I will tell you that part of our big challenge is the security systems that have been designed and built into the IT side of this are so complicated, they are the things that right now are causing most of our problems. How do you get one system to talk to the other? Because they are so robust. But I'll try to get you some additional information on the interfaces with the feds. The second question was the ACA, the federal legislation, requires employers, I believe it's all employers, to provide information to their employees about the existence of state or federal exchanges. And the purpose of that, I think, is whether it's family members or if they don't provide health insurance, the employees, there's kind of a model notice that they have to give to their employees. And, you know, I know that, for example, the Restaurant Association has been doing, putting those together and trying to figure out how to help their, you know, all the restaurants provide that. And the notice date, I think, is by October 1. There is no penalty, I believe, if they don't do it. It's one of these federal requirements without anything happen to if you don't do it. That's we don't have anything to do with that other than we took the model notices that the feds or the IRS provided and put it up on our website.
Okay, so just to be clear, it's not because you're actually taking small group policies at this point, right? Or that there's any requirement for the employer to move over to the exchange. It's just a broad sort of indirect
that is
federal
correct.
Mandate
that
to
is correct.
Notify everybody. Okay.
Yeah.
Other questions? Hey.
Thank
That's
you.
That's great. You didn't even take all of your time.
See you in November.
Yes.
Maybe.
All right. Thank you so much, Rocky and Amy. With that, I would like to call up Robert Lowe for the presentation on emergency department utilization.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. Really appreciate the opportunity to be here. I was asked to talk a bit about the role of emergency departments in healthcare reform in Oregon.
Please state your name for the record.
Oh, I'm Robert Lowe from Oregon Health and Science University.
Thank you.
And I understand we have about 20 minutes. I'll try to talk for about 15 to leave some time for questions and to get your reactions at the end.
Thank you.
I wanted to begin by talking about a patient we saw at OHSU a few years ago, and I've changed some details for the sake of privacy, but this is a real story of a 30-year-old man who came to the emergency department. He had an unusual...
Can you slide the microphone a little closer? I'm having trouble hearing.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, if you could shut the back door.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we need anything, or...
No,
I was joined by the 30-year-old man who came to the OHSU emergency department. He had an unusual bleeding disorder.
Now you're too close.
Okay. Testing, is this okay?
Yeah.
He had an unusual bleeding disorder that and had been taking an injectable medication once or twice a month. He stopped that a few months ago on his own and came in with bleeding from the bowels. He'd lost quite a bit of blood. He was probably going to need a blood transfusion and might need admission and a surgical procedure. Now, a lot of us would be tempted to say that this is an example of an unnecessary visit to the emergency department, someone who was not compliant with his medicines and who should have gone to his primary care doctor before he got this sick. But we asked him to tell his story, and it turned out that he was a handyman. He was on the Oregon Health Plan, had lost his benefits a few months ago, and was faced with the choice as a single parent of either spending $600 a month for the medication or paying for food and rent. And he made the choice many of us would make. The first medical event that happened after he stopped the medication was he bled into his elbow and ended up with a frozen elbow. Since he was in manual labor, he lost his job. And to quote from our conversation, he said, "It's hard on me, on an adult, you know, but what they put the kids through is just crazy. And we were an honest, hard-working family, and then I lose my job and all that stopped. And you know, I lose the car, I'm evicted from the house, the gas gets shut off, the electricity. You know, honestly, there was even like suicidal thoughts. If I just fix the gas heater, and we just all fall asleep, and not wake up the next day, and we wouldn't have to go through this anymore.
Yeah.
Thank you. And I tell that story because it illustrates the theme of what I want to share with you, which is the emergency department is the tip of the iceberg. Emergency department patients and looking at patterns of use don't just tell us about the ED. They tell us about the needs of the overall healthcare delivery system. And if we use the tip of the iceberg, the ED, to understand what's going on elsewhere, we have a chance to look at primary care, public health, social determinants of health, the whole spectrum of things that can ultimately lead to emergency department use. And I wanted to illustrate this with by talking about five common myths or misperceptions about ED use. The first is that there's a lot of inappropriate ED use. In fact, what seems minor after a visit may not seem minor before the visit. And a good example is someone my age who wakes up in the middle of the night with chest pain. And he may call his doctor, but they may not be able to tell over the phone whether this is a heart attack, life-threatening, or something much less serious. So it's quite reasonable for him to go to the emergency department. And let's say that after a thorough evaluation, the doctor says, "Good news, Mr. Jones. We don't think this is a heart problem. We think it's probably heartburn, and you can go home." Now, heartburn's not an emergency. And so some people might say, this wasn't an emergency, this is inappropriate use of the emergency department. But we only know that in retrospect. And it turns out, and there was a national study that looked at this recently, that the vast majority of patients coming to the emergency department have chief complaints that could be life-threatening or could be something like heartburn. And we can only tell after the evaluation. The other problem with the concept of inappropriate ED visits is it depends on what the alternatives are. A one-year-old who is crying, inconsolable with a fever, may not be an emergency on a Tuesday at 9 a.m. when the family has good access to primary care. But on a Friday at 9 p.m., if the family can't get telephone advice and they can't get an appointment to see a provider until sometime the next week, it may be the only safe or prudent thing to do is to bring that child to the emergency department. And before I had the sense to move to Oregon 12 years ago, I was involved in a study on the East Coast where we partnered with a Medicaid managed care organization and looked at our patients' use of the emergency department. We found that patients whose primary care doctors had 12 or more evening hours a week used the ED 20% less. And in a future of coordinated care organizations and patient-centered primary care homes, I get very excited about the opportunity to reduce reliance on EDs by improving access to timely primary care. Looking at kind of the dark side of that story, if we go back to 2003 when the state's fiscal situation forced cutbacks in the OHP, we saw an immediate very substantial rise in ED visits by the uninsured, about 20% jump the next month. There were specific cutbacks for the OHP standard in access to mental health care, and we saw a doubling in the number of drug-related, alcohol, and other psychiatric ED visits by the uninsured. The second common myth is that ED use is a major cost driver. In fact, EDs generate about 4% of U.S. healthcare costs. The big three are inpatient care, office-based providers, and prescriptions, and together they generate 73% of costs. So I get a little confused when people talk about saving money through focusing on the emergency department. And sometimes when I have this conversation with people, they will say, you know, Bob, sure, ED visits don't cost a lot, but they lead to expensive hospital admissions. And that's true. But I get confused with the idea that if someone is so sick that they need to be admitted to the hospital, we wouldn't want that patient to come to the emergency department. It seems the real opportunity is upstream, working with the primary care system to improve access to primary care and quality of primary care for chronic conditions like asthma, diabetes, and so on, so those patients don't get sick enough to need either the emergency department or the hospital. The third myth is that ED use for minor problems causes overcrowding. Most ED overcrowding in the U.S. is because of patients who are in the ED. A decision has been made that they're sick enough they require hospital admission, but there's no inpatient bed available. Those patients require a lot of nursing care, take a lot of our time, and create the overcrowding. It's been shown that if we got rid of the sore throats and sprained ankles in the emergency department, it wouldn't really make much difference. The fourth myth is that ED use disrupts continuity of care. The typical story is, you know, I've got asthma, and I go to my doctor for checkups, and when I'm a little sick, I call the office, and either they give me advice over the phone or I come in, but sometimes I get really short of breath, and I just can't breathe, and I need care right now, and I need more treatment than my doctor's office has, so I go to the emergency department. And the data bears this story out. In one national survey of patients with four or more ED visits in a year, over 80% had a usual source of care. And these were individuals who tended to use outpatient care and just had poor physical health. There is a group of super users, and we, a few years ago, looked at members of the OHP who had not four visits a year, but over 75 visits in a four-year period. And there weren't many of them. They represent about 0.02% of OHP enrollees, but they're a highly vulnerable population that faces a triple threat. They have unstable primary care. Most of them had two, three, or even four primary care providers over the four-year period. They have a major burden of physical health problems and a major burden of mental health problems. So it's no wonder that they come to the ED so much. And again, there's a great opportunity with healthcare reform to provide comprehensive case management, to stabilize their access to primary care, and to integrate physical and mental health care so they get everything they need. And yes, they use the ED less, but more important, their health improves. And then the last myth I wanted to talk about is that it's easy to reduce so-called unnecessary ED visits. And the two strategies that are talked about the most are triage and copayments. And triage, either talking with people by phone or seeing them in person and saying, you need the emergency department and you don't, usually works. There is a known risk. Some of the patients who would be sent out of the ED require hospitalization the same day. Some of them have been shown to have adverse outcomes. And again, it's a small proportion. But given how little money is on the table that could be saved with a system like this, I have a hard time justifying it. In terms of copayments, copayments for ED visits may work in a middle-class population. But when Neil Wallace and John McConnell studied this in OHP in Oregon, when there was a $50 copay for some members of the OHP, they found an 8% drop in ED use and an 8% rise in the cost per visit when patients came to the ED. They also found a 27% increase in inpatient use. So my interpretation of this is that it did have some effect in terms of patients delaying care, but those patients got sicker. Some of them got sicker, and the result was that they came to the ED requiring more intensive and more expensive care, or even hospital admission. The third strategy to reduce ED visits, I think, is very promising, and that's to use ED data to understand opportunities to work outside the ED. For instance, among uninsured Oregonians coming to EDs, 1 out of 20 is there primarily for a dental condition. We're doing some work with the Oregon Oral Health Collaborative to try to, my wife told me not to use this expression, but I will try to drill down on the reasons those patients come to the ED, where they're coming from, and try to improve the safety net for dental conditions. Another example is, turns out that among women coming to the ED who are eventually diagnosed with intimate partner violence, only half of those have the diagnosis recorded on the first visit. And we think there's a population of relatively young women on OHP or uninsured who have repeated ED visits for minor injuries who may well be victims of intimate partner violence. They may go to multiple EDs, so I may not be able to recognize that by looking at OHSU ED records, but it seems like with coordination of care, the CCOs may be able to use their data to recognize patients they should be reaching out to. And then the last example I wanted to give is a few years ago, we looked statewide at emergency department use by OHP enrollees, divided the state into 120 communities that included all of the state, and we found more than a tenfold variation in how often OHP patients go to the ED in different communities. Some of that seems to have to do with access to primary care, but it seems like there's a real chance for high-use communities to learn from our neighbors about what works to not just save the cost of ED visits, but really improve access to care and improve the health of the population. So in conclusion, if the emergency department is the tip of the iceberg, we've got two ways of looking at ED visits. We can look at ED visits as the problem, and that's kind of like cutting off the tip of the iceberg. Most of the ice is underwater, and it's just going to rise a bit, and we won't really have done anything. Or we can look at the emergency department as the source of information, talking to patients like the gentleman with the bleeding disorder, looking at data the way I've illustrated here, to really understand what's going on with primary care, public health, and many other aspects of healthcare delivery, so we can really improve the health of Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Lowe. I know that we have studied ED utilization. I don't think it's necessarily the tip of the iceberg, but I do believe that part of preventative care, as you said, with primary care access will decrease. And I forget the millions and millions and millions of dollars that we will save according to some actuarial data that we received in I don't remember when, but you know, last session or the session before, that's just a small component of if we can decrease that, that actually will save money for the global budget that we are giving to our coordinated care organizations. So, yeah, but thank you very much for the information. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Lowe, thank you very much for coming, and I appreciate the Chair putting this on the agenda. I've been really impressed with your research and your publications, and I think it's something that our committees should lean on. One of the frustrations I've had in North and Northeast Portland is you've shown me a map that indicates we have some of the highest ED utilization in the entire state in that portion, and there is a hospital right there. Our CCO seems to be, you know, getting itself off the ground pretty well. There's urgent cares that are popping up around everywhere else in the city, but there's no urgent cares popping up in North and Northeast Portland. And the ones that are doing 9-to-5 care, so they're not providing that 12 hours per week that you were talking about. Could you underline the importance of the correlation you've mentioned about how doctors' offices or providers' offices that are opened longer tended to decrease ED utilization? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Shields. We found that primary care providers who had 12 or more evening hours a week, their patients used the emergency department 20% less than patients whose primary care docs didn't have evening hours. And we would expect a similar pattern with expanded hours in a high-use community like North Portland. It's a real opportunity there to, as Chair Monis Anderson pointed out, to reduce ED use in a way that saves money, but not by keeping people out of the ED, but by offering them a good alternative.
And Madam Chair, if I know that people are listening. I would be grateful if the CCOs and the organizations that are part of the CCOs in Multnomah County could report back to us on what kind of after-hours primary care they offer for adults, but also in pediatrics, because it seems to me that, and you might want to comment on this, infants tend to use the emergency room more than anybody else. They really need to be more self-sufficient, I think. But
probably in the middle of the night.
That was a joke. But I would be interested in getting a report on the CCOs, at least in my part of the world, on any after hours they have. Because what you're saying is that that has clear evidence of decreasing ED utilization, right?
Yeah, thank you very much. I would be happy to work with you offline in looking at some of that information in its relation to ED use.
Great. Thank you.
We have a question from Representative Kenmore.
Thank you. More maybe a comment. I just appreciate you telling us some other sides of this story. As a member of this committee for a long time, I guess I've been treated to quite a few dissertations on the overutilization of emergency departments. And in fact, Dr. Goldberg even today talked about how we've seen dramatic reductions in its utilization, and supposedly this is going to be a huge cost saver for us. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's a good reminder that these topics are a little more complicated.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Kenmore. Dan Handel and John McConnell at OHSU did a study looking at the potential cost savings in the Oregon Health Plan. And, of course, it's a new system now. But they projected that at most it could save 2% of the OHP budget. And that would be offset by the added administrative costs and the added care that people would get elsewhere. But I don't disagree with what Dr. Goldberg said, because if what the CCOs are doing is providing better access outside, it's going to keep people healthier, save ED costs, inpatient costs, and do the right thing.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lowe. Rob Ovay, Gary Schnabel, Bill Cross, they're going to be talking about e-prescribing.
Nikki.
Anyway, e-prescribing of Schedule II drugs, and evidently this is a concept that the House is considering for legislation, and I thought it would be good for us to hear that also. So who's going to go first?
I guess I will, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you, Nikki.
Nikki Terzia here on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy
Association,
as well as the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists. With these two gentlemen joining, I may, with your permission, defer and let them walk through some of the background of the bill. That's all right.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
I'm Gary Schnabel. I'm Executive Director for the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. And I don't know if you got a copy of my talking points. Sandy sent them this morning. They wanted to just be brief and walk through these quick talking points. Electronic prescribing of prescription drugs has become mainstream in the last couple of years. And it's been to everybody's advantage. Electronic prescribing for controlled substances was a little slower to catch on because of the federal requirements. but that now has also been approved by the federal government. So electronic prescribing of all controlled substances is allowed under federal law. We still have a prohibition in the Oregon Controlled Substances Act against electronic prescribing of Schedule II controlled substances. And so what we're asking is that that prohibition be removed to make Oregon law consistent with federal law. We think the Oregon Board of Pharmacy thinks that Oregon law should be permissive where federal law allows electronic prescribing for controlled substances.
I have a question. How many states right now allow it for?
I don't know exactly. It's in the neighborhood of 30. It's the majority of states
that
allow it. I had five advantages listed here. There are fewer illegible prescriptions. There will be fewer errors. There will be fewer questions from pharmacists, fewer fake prescriptions, and greater patient safety. I think it's a win-win. I think we need to do it.
The only question I have is about security of the system and how easily, what kind of firewalls are up to protect abuse mainly.
Sure, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and those are the federal requirements, and they're very strict. The software and the hardware from both the prescriber and the pharmacy dispenser both have to be certified to meet all those criteria for integrity and security and authenticity of the prescription, so that the person who sent the prescription can't say, that wasn't me. It's a positive identification for the prescriber.
So who has been opposition? I mean, is there any opposition?
We haven't seen any opposition.
ACLU, I don't think, is in the room. No, they don't have. Okay.
Representative Greenlick, do you have any questions?
My understanding is this isn't anything different. It's a class we missed. Is that right? We have this electronic prescribing for other classes of drugs.
Right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Greenlick, that's correct. This is just really an oversight. We thought we had fixed it. We do allow electronic prescribing of Schedule 3 through 5 controlled substances. It's only the Schedule 2s that we haven't fixed yet.
Great.
And that's why they're here.
Nikki?
Sure. Nikki Terziev here, still on behalf of the State Pharmacy Association as well as the Society of Health System Pharmacists. We're here in support of this bill. This was previously HB 3522. It was heard at the very end of days in the last legislative session, full legislative session. Managed to make it out of rules and then went into the Senate, and the President, of course, is holding strict to his timelines, and so we weren't able to kind of realize this bill then. But this is, if you want something that's not very controversial, this would be a great place to start and kick off the next February session. The LC will remain supported by us. This is about patient safety. It's about patient convenience. You won't have Class 2 prescriptions walking down the street with Aunt Mildred in her pocketbook. It'll be prescribing security. Just so you know, Madam Chair, a lot of our pharmacists already use and already have electronic systems like this. It was very rigorous for login, very rigorous for the transmittal protocols within the software system itself. And we'll continue to work it.
Great. Yes, Senator Cruz, yeah, and then Rob Bouvet, do you have any comments?
Question for Representative Greenlick. Mitch, is this going to be one of your committee bills?
It'll either be one of my committee bills or I'll do it as a personal bill.
Okay, so.
But I'm assuming it'll be a committee bill.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Representative Conger?
I'm sorry if I missed this. Can you give me an example? What's a Schedule II drug?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Ovette, Lincoln County District Attorney, strongly in favor of us fixing this. A Schedule II drug, a typical example would be oxycodone, OxyContin. There's a variety of other Class II drugs. They're the ones that are probably the most highly susceptible to abuse and misuse, which is why they're in Schedule II. The difference between Schedule II and Schedule III primarily is you can't get refills, and right now you have to get a written script. I just add one just brief comment, which is the world is going electronic. I believe that within our generation, there won't be written prescriptions anymore. Everything is going to be securely transmitted electronically, and we just have this clunky old statute that we just need to fix.
Any other questions?
Clunky old statute.
Anyone else that wants to testify? I saw Bill Cross.
Well, Nikki, he went.
You took your
I
place.
Took
Good.
Yes.
Okay.
I
thought he was going to be. All right, thank you so very much. And with that, we will go to John Mullen, Janet Bauer, and Alberto Moreno on the presentation of the basic health options.
If anybody isn't able to...
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the Joint Committee, for the record, John Mullen from the Oregon Law Center. We appreciate the opportunity to be here today to talk about the basic health plan. First of all, as is obvious from the discussion today, there are lots of things going on in Oregon. We have the work of the CCOs. We have the Cover Oregon and getting ready for the opening of that in a couple of weeks. And there are lots of things that we've done that we do the Oregon way that involve waivers, coordination, additional resources. So there's lots going on, and yet at the same time, we're here today to talk to you about something we've talked to the House Committee about in the past, and we've testified at the Oregon Health Policy Board, Medicaid Advisory Committee, also to the Cover Oregon Board, about concerns that we have about issues relating to affordability, churn, continuity of care. One of the things we don't know as we start off on this whole process is who is going to show up on October 1st through open enrollment period. A number of us are worried about the lower income population and whether affordability will be a real barrier for them to get insurance. And we're talking about the population 138% of federal poverty level to 200% of federal poverty level. We're also concerned about legal immigrants who have a five-year bar. Well, fortunately, there's a provision written into the Affordable Care Act called the Basic Health Plan, which gives states the opportunity to take a look at a way of covering those populations I mentioned. And I'm not going to take a whole lot of time because Janet Bauer is going to provide you with a lot of the information, and Alberto Moreno will also be talking about the legal immigrant issue and also to wrap up. But I would say that Representative Greenlick, who's on the phone today, was very helpful in working with the advocates to have a meeting that we had on August 23rd, and both chairs were there today, as well as Representative Greenlick and Representative Thompson. And we got together with some of the advocates as well as the OHA staff and Cover Oregon staff. And what we did at that meeting is we raised, not only did we raise our level of understanding by having some national experts that also helped us out that day, but we also identified a number of questions that we're still taking a look at and examining. So what's in front of you today is basically what we hope to be able to do, a little bit of an update. Now, understanding that some of you have had an opportunity for more discussion about the basic health plan, we want to be sure that people have sort of the same level of understanding about it. So I'm going to turn to Janet, and Janet is going to go through some of the specifics about the basic health plan, and then Alberto will respond specifically about the legal immigrant issues, but also wrap up, and we're here, of course, to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair, Mona Sanderson, and Representative Kenny Geyer, and members of the committee. My name is Janet Bauer. I'm a policy analyst at Oregon Center for Public Policy. Our interest in basic health stems from our concerns about affordability for individuals in Oregon's exchange shopping in its individual market. Before I talk briefly about what basic health is, I'd like to share a bit about our assessments about costs for a typical low-income person in a standard-level silver plan in Cover Oregon. Is there some way I can advance a slide? So we have just two slides today here. This will be probably the shortest PowerPoint presentation you'll ever have. But the example I like to talk about is a person in about the middle of the low-income range shopping in Cover, Oregon, and that person would have an annual income of about $18,000 a year, and this is for a one-person household. The federal subsidies available to that person would bring that person's premium down so that his or her contribution would be 4.5% of his or her income, household income. That percent of household income contribution is set by federal law, not by Cover Oregon. So that would mean that the enrollee's premium cost would be $820 a month, or about $820 per year, or about $68 per month. The question is, how do we know if this is affordable for someone at this income level? And after looking at some research, we found that there is some reason for concern. Great. For example, research among state programs that charge premiums to low-income households shows that premium costs make a significant difference in program participation. The research by Koo that is illustrated in this slide found that a household contribution of 1% of income would result in 57% participation amongst those eligible. Premiums set at 4% of household income would result in just 25% of those eligible participating, as illustrated in the second pink bar. The 4% instance, the latter example, is close to the contribution level of someone in Cover, Oregon at 160% of the federal poverty level I mentioned. It's this kind of research that raises our concerns about affordability for individuals in the exchange and our interest in basic health as a potential solution. And that's all for the PowerPoint.
It's now a good time to ask a question.
Go ahead.
So I see that slide's from 1999, and
yes.
It makes a lot of intuitive sense that the more it costs or the more it consumes of a person's income, especially at low income, it's going to make more of a difference. But isn't there another factor? Isn't there a penalty if you're uninsured now under the Affordable Care Act? So, and did you consider what that would do to change that, the trajectory of that curve?
There are analyses that have considered that factor, and certainly that's an important point. I haven't looked at research that would as clearly break down participation by income level as this particular study did. And I think that your point is a really well taken for us as we look at it. And hopefully participation would be higher than what's indicated by this study.
And Madam Chair, as Representative Conger, if I may, one of the things that we recognize is that we're in uncharted territory. We don't know exactly how all of this is going to work. One of the things about basic health plan is that the draft regulations are not out until sometime later this month for implementation in 2015. So what that will give us is an opportunity to really take a look at who shows up and what barriers there might be for people to sign up.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. So in just a few minutes, I'd like to give you a briefing on what a basic health program looks like and what it might, how we might think about it operating in Oregon. As John mentioned, it is an option for states under the Affordable Care Act. A number of states, including Minnesota, are working towards instituting the program. It would serve Oregonians who are eligible to shop in Cover Oregon's individual market and who have incomes above the Medicaid expansion level at 138% of federal poverty level, up to 200% of poverty. In addition, it could also serve legal immigrants who would otherwise be served by Medicaid because of their incomes, however, are excluded from Medicaid due to a 5-year residency requirement. The individuals would be served by basic health and not by Cover, would be served by basic health and not by Cover Oregon's individual market plans if we were to institute it. Oregon could operate basic health in a number of ways, including by expanding the Oregon Health Plan to include that group.
Hey, Janet.
Representative Greenland? Yes.
Go ahead.
I think the point you made is an important one. If we do basic health and we can't do the exchange with subsidies with 138% to 200%, is that right?
For that Madam Chair, Representative Greenlick, that would be correct. The option for subsidized exchange coverage would not be available for that income population. So, as I mentioned, Oregon could operate basic health in a number of ways, including expanding the Oregon Health Plan. That would be one of a number of possible structures for the program. Basic health funding would come from the federal government. The feds would give the state the funds that it would otherwise be spending on premium subsidies and copay subsidies for that population if they had been in the exchange. Preliminary analysis by the Urban Institute shows that the federal basic health funds to states would be more than enough to provide a Medicaid-like benefit package, making it possible for basic health premiums and cost sharing to be substantially lower than for exchange plans. And except for administrative costs, the analysis finds that no state contribution would be necessary. The federal government, as John mentioned, is expected to propose administrative rules on the program later this month, and those rules will help states like our state determine what the level of basic health funding would be to Oregon and clarify a number of issues that lawmakers had in that meeting on August 23rd. And due to that federal timeline on rulemaking, the program could begin no earlier than 2015. If Oregon is to consider basic health, we believe a state-specific analysis is needed in order to know how much it could bring down premiums and what its impact on Oregon's exchange might be, and answering a number of other questions, including the means for covering administrative costs, which also need to be explored. So I've provided a fact sheet handout, and it's also available electronically, that we developed earlier this year to further describe how a basic health program would work in Oregon and what questions that still remain regarding how it would operate. So, as we know, health reform won't stop after January 2014, and improvements will obviously still need to be made. And we appreciate your interest in the issues in implementation, including coverage affordability, and look forward to continuing to work with you on solutions to any problems that might arise. And thank you very much. I'm happy to take questions.
I have the same concern. I know $68 a month, which 68.33, if you divide that 820 and 12, but I think that we really will need data from what Cover Oregon, who is coming into Cover Oregon. But I found it very interesting to come with this concept because this, I think, is a population that is not going to participate, and we need to look at ways to figure out how to get them covered. Other questions?
We need to get Alberta to vote.
Alberto.
Yeah, Alberto, do you have some more comments?
I was pleading that you not leave me alone up here all by myself. Chair, Vice Chair, my name is Alberto Moreno. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Latino Health Coalition. I also have the honor and privilege of serving as the newly elected Chair for the Commission on Hispanic Affairs. Representative Harker sits on that commission with me and is our sponsor, so we're delighted to be in your presence. The Affordable Care Act and healthcare reform in Oregon presumes that everyone is taken care of. But I think what we want to do is we want to remind you and our colleagues that that is indeed not the case, that we anticipate that as many as 200,000 individuals and children are still not being folded into the Affordable Care Act, who are categorically excluded from accessing those benefits and those services. Some of those communities include undocumented children. We estimate there are 22,000 to 28,000 children undocumented alone in the state of Oregon who are excluded from that. There are about 160,000 undocumented adults who are also excluded from the Affordable Care Act. And lastly, there are about, we estimate, 7,000 legal permanent residents. Let me repeat that so that I'm clear. Legal permanent residents who are excluded from Medicaid in the state. We see the basic health program as an option to ensure coverage for those legally residing permanent adults in the state of Oregon who are here legally, who are working, who are paying taxes, whose families are attending school, who are making meaningful financial contributions. This basic health plan gives us a vehicle by which we can address what we consider a significant policy gap. It makes sense to us because we bring more folks into the pool of paying adults. These adults tend to be younger, and so they tend to be healthier. And if we exclude them from care in the beginning of that process, what we're doing through our policy is we're driving worse health outcomes. Does that make sense? This discussion this gentleman was having here about emergency room utilization, it is, I would maintain, our policy which is driving that kind of behavior. And so we have before us an opportunity to redesign health policy at the state level, which would fold folks into the same kind of benefits that we all enjoy in the room. It is the right thing to do. It makes economic sense for us. And again, this is a class of adults who are residing legally. You might ask, why is that the case? We don't think we understand why that decision was made. It represents an old kind of thinking that these folks first need to earn their way for the first 5 years. We don't believe that that kind of thinking lifts us all, that it contributes to our collective well-being. And so we have an opportunity before us to redress those policies and to amend them. I think what I also want to say in terms of wrapping up the conversation, and I know that you'll have questions, is we're not asking you today. Sorry, thank you. This microphone and I are not getting along very well.
Further away.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Clearly, I'm not practiced at this. Is that better?
Yes.
Thank you. You're being so patient. In terms of wrapping up this fairly discordant conversation, we're not asking you to vote today to adopt a basic health plan. That is not what we're asking you to do. We're asking you to join us in exploration for us to collectively do our due diligence around what are the economic benefits of changing this policy, of bringing more folks into the circle of care. That is all we're doing. We're not saying today you have to vote either yes or no on this option. We are saying let us do what we are obligated to do as a state and that is, let us crunch numbers, let us do a cost-benefit analysis, let us look at best practices from other states who have taken advantage of this, and let's see what is possible. Let us continue that rich tradition that Oregon observes, and that is a rich tradition of innovation, that is a rich tradition of asking not why shouldn't we do this, but how can we do this? I think that is the source of the greatness of our state, and I should like us to continue on that path. I should like us to have you join us to ask those questions and see what possible benefits we can collectively garner from this.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate the being educated on this.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. With that, I'd like to, we have one final, Katrina Hedberg. I didn't go on the back page. So Katrina, please come forward. Dr. Hedberg, state epidemiologist, on the presentation of healthcare acquired infection report.
Thank you, and I do have slides. I think she's coming down to get you.
And Diane Waldo?
She's here yet. Okay. Supposed to be around 4, but so she may come in.
Yes. Madam Chair, I apologize for being off. While they're setting up, could I just say one thing?
Yes.
Since I missed the part about e-prescribing, we've done that already, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Really important. Got to do it. Patient safety. Doctors are fed up. I hope that's what you heard from everybody else.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry, I had 3 bill signings
House
in a row.
Committee bill.
House okay, good.
Or Mitch's personal bill.
Fabulous. Thank
not
you very
support.
Much. We got to get it through. It's going to be much better for patient safety. Am I in the right chair at this point?
Yes.
Everybody's chair moved over.
Yes, Senator Knope, you are.
Thank you, Representative.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chairs and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg, and I'm the state epidemiologist and the acting health officer for the Public Health Division in the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here to talk about healthcare-acquired infections and give you an update on where we are in Oregon. We just published a report, and I think you all got this emailed out to you. It's a thick report, but that's what I'm going to be talking about today. So a lot of the material is in the report. Healthcare-associated infections are important because everybody comes into contact with the healthcare system at some point. Often we come into contact with the healthcare system because we're sick, and we don't want to get sicker. So infections make us sicker, they cost more, they make people stay in the hospital longer. So what are healthcare-acquired infections? We use a definition that the Centers for Disease Control uses. Basically, a healthcare-acquired infection is an infection that patients acquire during the course of having received treatment for other conditions within a healthcare setting. And where do these occur? Basically, they occur in numerous healthcare settings, acute care hospital, and that's really what I'm going to be talking about mostly today. But they also occur in long-term care facilities, ambulatory surgery centers, and outpatient dialysis centers, among others. They're very costly. They contribute to over 99,000 deaths a year in the United States, and they are one of the 10 leading causes of death. They're really expensive. $36 to $45 billion a year are spent in treating healthcare-acquired infections in the United States. And it's estimated that about 5% of patients who come into the hospital acquire a healthcare-acquired infection at some point. And they can also spread from hospitals back into the community, and so this is of concern, particularly as we're talking about antibiotic-resistant organisms, which I'll refer to in a little bit. And most of them are preventable, and so that's really why we need to address them, is to decrease healthcare costs. So the area of concern, when we look at how people get these, patients can get them through devices that are associated, and I know there's a little jargon here with the initials underneath, but basically devices, CLABSI is a central line-associated bloodstream infection, VAP is ventilator-associated, CAUTI is catheter-associated UTIs, SSIs are surgery or surgical site infections. And again, people can get them both from spreading from surfaces, healthcare workers, from other patients. There are a variety of organisms that cause these as well. And again, I mentioned a moment ago that the ones that we're really concerned about are the ones that are highly resistant to antibiotics, because then when you get them, it's extremely difficult to treat these. So Clostridium difficile is an infection of the gastrointestinal tract. I mentioned the resistant ones. Candida is a yeast infection. Bloodborne viruses can occur in hospital settings as well. So there are a number of activities related to healthcare-acquired infections across the United States. And basically, they fall into a couple of categories of steps that different states are taking. One is that we monitor infections around the country, and the other are prevention activities. So when we look at monitoring, that's looking at what states have instituted reporting laws for healthcare-acquired infections. And you can see here in green, Oregon is one of the ones that mandates reporting. Now, it turns out that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid also require or have pay for performance related to reporting of these. So essentially, HAIs, or healthcare-acquired infections, are reportable around the United States. So reporting is one thing. In addition to that, of course, we need to figure out how we can implement prevention strategies to deal with this. And we need to be doing this in partnership. And so here are listed a number of the organizations that we've partnered closely with. And I'll mention them a little bit more by name in just a minute. So back in 2009, healthcare-acquired infections became reportable in Oregon, and the goals of this were to raise awareness about the issue of these infections, to inform consumers, and to make it public. And again, the report I mentioned just a moment ago has infection rates by hospital as well, so consumers can be aware of what those infection rates are by hospitals. And then they're also, of course, to aid the healthcare facilities in decreasing the infections. Again, data is only as good as it can be used to drive policy. Initially, we had the central line associated knee prosthesis replacement, as well as the coronary artery bypass graft were reportable, and a number of surgical sites listed here. Now, when we made these reportable, there's a Centers for Disease Control system that is called the National Healthcare Safety Network that was already in place. And so we wanted to be sure that we weren't reinventing the wheel here. This is a system whereby there's over 11,000 facilities across the United States that report their healthcare-acquired infections to CDC, and this is the tool that we used here in Oregon. What's nice about this is it represents not only the infections that are occurring, but also what we call denominators. That is, how many of these surgeries, how many of the procedures, how many of the devices are being inserted. So we can actually look at the percentage that are being done. We can calculate a rate. It also helps us to come up with some national norms, and so we can compare what's happening in Oregon to what's happening across the country. And we do this by looking at what's called a standardized infection ratio, but the idea here is that hospitals with sicker patients or more severe might be more likely to see these kinds of infections than hospitals that aren't treating as severe. So it's a way to control for some severity of illness. Now, I mentioned a moment ago that we did not do this in isolation. We had an advisory committee that represented a variety of stakeholders. I mentioned the Hospital Association, quality improvement, infection control, ambulatory care, long-term care. It's important that we also had a consumer representatives on as the stakeholders and on our committee as well, infectious disease physicians, and then the Oregon Health Authority. And as I mentioned, this was both to help us guide what would be reportable, what should be mandated as reporting, and then transitioning from that, what's reportable, to actually coming up with prevention steps, and to provide a venue that stakeholders could talk about different prevention that needed to be done in the healthcare settings. So I'll now present some data, and I'll go through these relatively quickly. Again, you've got all the report, and I'd be happy to answer any questions specifically about them. When I present the data, I'm doing it in a couple of ways on this, and in this report, it's looked at a third way, which talks about that standardized infection ratio as well. I'm not going to be presenting that on the slides today, but that compares how Oregon is doing nationally. So on the left of this are the rates of infections per days in the hospital. And then the other thing we looked at was how many hospitals were reporting. And I use the flip side here so that you can look at trends. So how many hospitals are not reporting any infections? So the first one here has to do with the central line associated bloodstream infections. And as you can see, the rate has continued to decline between 2009 and 2012, pretty much a steady decline, both in the rate that these infections were occurring, and then the second piece is, and the percent of hospitals, or the number of hospitals that were reporting any infection. So these trends are both going in the same direction, and this is very good news.
Question?
Yes, please.
Details. What's the asterisk by 2009 meeting?
That is a mistake, so I apologize for that.
Okay.
Thank you, and I'm sorry. Someone else helped prepare the slides, and there was an asterisk previously, which similarly, I'm sorry, should have been deleted from the slide. So when this is the same thing, but this is looking at neonatal intensive care unit, and here the data are somewhat mixed. You can see that the rate is flat or has increased slightly, and the percent of hospitals reporting any infections has gone down. So that's not quite sure what to make of that. Abdominal hysterectomy, surgical site infection, again, this is very flat. Colon site surgery, similarly, very flat and not a whole lot of change. Here, from the previous one showed 4 years' worth of data. We actually added some more sites that were reportable, so these only have 2 years' worth of data. So just to note that we certainly can see we potentially could see a trend when we have a few more years. Coronary artery bypass graft, the surgical site, again, this is good news, appears to be decreasing both in the percent of procedures that have these infections as well as the hospitals that report any infection. For the 2 years in these, again, slight decrease with the hip replacement surgical site, but basically the percent of hospitals reporting is flat. And knee replacement, very flat. Laminectomy, surgical site, also pretty flat. Now, Clostridium difficile is a little bit different. That, as I mentioned, is an infection of the GI tract, and it's related to antibiotic use. That puts patients at increased risk, but it's also spread in hospital settings. So this has something to do with spread either on surfaces in the hospital as well or by healthcare workers. And we have a slight increase. No, I'm sorry. I apologize. This is only 1 year of data, 2012, and what we looked at is two things. People can get it in the community onset, and they can get it in the healthcare facility. It actually works both ways, and you can see that the rate from hospital acquired is slightly higher than the rate of community acquired. And the percent of hospitals reporting any infection is around 70%, so that's relatively high. Another area that's a little bit different but is very important when we're talking about healthcare-acquired infections has to do with influenza vaccination. We know that people go in the hospital and are sick, and during flu season, they don't want to come out getting flu from a healthcare worker. Between 60 and 65% of healthcare workers have been immunized against influenza, so that means at least a third have not. So that's relatively flat, and that's an area where we've got our work cut out for us, I think.
And you know that's highly charged in the legislature. We tried, I don't know how many sessions, to address.
Yes, Madam Chair, I am presenting information for you. Okay, so I'll just briefly talk about some of our healthcare-acquired infection projects that we've been doing. So one of the things that we want to do is, because the data into the NHSN are reported by the hospitals themselves, we want to be sure to validate those data. And so we've gotten some funding from the Centers for Disease Control to go in and sample both hospitals that report infections and charts. And our validation studies show that the reporting is very good. We will continue to do validation of that, but we've actually gotten kudos from CDC for our validation studies. So we're one of the states who have done this very, very assertively. So we were one of two states that had been funded to increase, to continue validation. I mentioned about the multi-drug resistant organisms. Again, we've been funded by the Centers for Disease Control to look into this. And of particular concern is this carbapenem resistant Enterobacteriaceae, which again is a lot of concern. I think about 15% of the hospitals on the East Coast have this organism. And here in Oregon, we've only had three cases so far, but we've been looking into those aggressively to make sure that we don't get further spread from those. Oregon has our Detect and Protect, which is doing real-time surveillance for these organisms and then intervening at that time with things like patient isolation, et cetera. We've been written up, again, by the Centers for Disease Control for being a model program in this area. And we have a number of emerging infections program studies that we've done as well to look at a variety of these organisms as well as antibiotic use in the hospital. So finally, I'll just mention this briefly around some of the collaborations, and then there's going to be more discussion from the Hospital Association about some of the work that that they've been doing. But a lot of this relates to helping hospitals with appropriate use of antibiotics. We get expert training aimed at decreasing inappropriate use. I'm looking at both the types of antibiotics that are used, the dose, the duration, et cetera, to make sure that we're not developing more antibiotic resistant organism. We are looking at preventing bloodstream infections as well, and there's toolkits that healthcare facilities can use to look at things like checklists and making sure that there's hand hygiene and so limiting the amount of spread that happens and in those settings. And finally, the multi-drug resistant organism prevention, we're in the process of writing some administrative rules to look at transport of patients between hospitals and long-term care facilities. Because again, if you have a patient infected, they don't need to just stay in the hospital. Obviously, they may need long-term care. At the same time, it's really important for us to not spread these organisms once a patient has been transferred to a long-term care facility. It's very important to continue communication between between the two sites. So to summarize, we've implemented reporting of the healthcare acquired infections with the assistance of the advisory committee, and we've done a initial validation of the publicly reported data. And some of the findings indicate that we've had some declines in places, but in others, so far, the result is mixed. And we've initiated prevention efforts with strong support from CDC. And I'll just end with, there's something that CDC is putting out now, which is called a prevention status report, to look at how well states are implementing different preventive practices. And they've done one on healthcare-associated infections. And Oregon actually gets a green light, both for how well we've done in validating the healthcare-acquired infections, as well as how well we have participated in statewide HAI prevention efforts. So again, I think we are doing quite well as a state compared to others, but that doesn't mean we don't have our work cut out for us. Thank you.
Go ahead. Good afternoon. I know you've had a long day. Chair Senator Manas Anderson and Chair Representative Kenny Geyer and members of the Joint Healthcare Committee. My name is Diane Waldo. I'm from the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, where I'm an Associate Vice President of Quality and Clinical Operations. And I just wanted to take a couple of minutes today to share with you some information about work that we are currently doing with Oregon hospitals that directly aligns and contributes to the infection report that Dr. Hedberg told you about.
Oregon is part of a national effort, the Partnership for Patients, to address two major goals in our state: to decrease preventable harm by 40% and to decrease preventable readmissions by 20%, all by December of this year, which is just around the corner. This work is sponsored by CMS, with flow down to the states through what is called a hospital engagement network. And in our case, that is through HRET, or the Health Research and Educational Trust of the American Hospital Association. So the primary strategy is to really standardize evidence-based best practice to avoid hospital-acquired conditions, and some of those are what Dr. Hedberg told you about, CLABSI, CAUTI, SSI, C. difficile. And I know you have a handout coming around to you that I prepared for your reference. So we're making progress and have demonstrated a decline in 8 of the 10 focus areas that is engaged with this work. We do that by engaging hospitals both on a local level, a state level, and a national level. We bring them together to network and to learn from each other. We've had special coordination with our rural hospitals because they need special coordination, meaning very much hands-on with site visits to those hospitals, bringing our education and our networking opportunities to them, to a town near them, and also incorporating lean training throughout the state, where we have trained over 150 hospital staff members in lean methodology to help them decrease waste and increase their efficiency and to sustain their quality improvement efforts. So I'll just pause there to see if you have any questions.
I have a question. In some of the slides that you showed, it showed that the rates have gone down and the number of some of the rates had stayed similar, but the number of hospitals reporting problems had gone down, which led me to think that of the ones that still are reporting, they must have more to even that out. And I'm wondering if you're doing a study to see what is the difference between those that are reducing their incidence versus those that actually must be increasing in order for those numbers to come out the way they did. That makes sense.
So I can begin that. Sometimes an increased focus on the area that you're addressing may lead to better reporting and better reporting than previously, so they may be discovering more. But in addition to that, we are looking at their data on a monthly basis, so much more frequent than we have before, mm-hmm. and trying to engage them in those efforts on a continuous basis. So your point is well taken, and that is certainly part of our strategy.
And the idea of looking at what are the things that worked for those that are bringing it down and sharing those things.
Right. We call those bright spots.
Yes, so, Madam Chair, if I could just comment on that as well. When we saw trends, the ones that had 4 years, that I'm more comfortable that that's a true trend. When I see 1 year that's up or down, yeah. I need to see more years to see whether or not it's true. And I would agree that one of the goals of this was actually to put a spotlight on different hospitals and health systems to see what they were doing. And so it could highlight some of the changes you might see may have more to do with the spotlight than actual change one way or the other. But having a spotlight does mean that it's an opportunity to implement those measures. And so, again, that's where things like checklists and toolkits and other resources that healthcare facilities can use comes into play.
Okay, great. And we have a question from Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Katrina. One of the motivations on the part of my constituents who argued very hard for this program to begin was that they wanted to have an easy way to compare among hospitals. They're going in to get a hip replacement. Does it matter which hospital they go to? The tables here couldn't possibly be more obfuscated of the ability to allow individual citizens to make any sense out of this. Do you have any plan at all to try and present data in a way? I know the Hospital Association wants you all to protect everything. You don't want anything to be really available. But do you have any plans at all to try to make this stuff actually accessible to the individual patients?
So, Madam Chairs and Representative Greenlick, I think that at this point, one of the things that's difficult, of course, is that there's so many things that go into what's happening at each hospital. And I had mentioned that there was some effort nationally to look at this standardized infection ratio to control for things like number of procedures or severity of illness, because some of these might happen in patients who've transferred, and obviously that there might be other things going on. So side-by-side comparisons, and I certainly know that those have been done by other organizations, not necessarily for healthcare-acquired infections, but consumers like those, we want to be sure that that isn't necessarily misleading either, because there may be things that tertiary care hospitals have in place. For example, how long staff have been working at the hospital, how many students or trainees they have come in. So if you have a checklist and you've trained a lot of people, people who are using that on a routine basis might be more comfortable with that than people who, again, are younger students or are rotating through, et cetera.
Madam Chair, may I follow up?
Yes, please.
Katrina, you're 4 years into this thing now. I've been hearing this nonsense right from the beginning. I understand exactly about risk adjustment. I really do. But I also understand that if you had a front page story in the Oregonian that said, say, Emmanuel had twice the hip replacement infection rate that St. Vincent's did, I would bet that that would change in Emmanuel over the next year. And, I mean, somewhere along the line, we need to be, if there are examples where there really are differences among the hospitals in a particular area, we need to find a relatively straightforward way for you to present this to the public. I mean, you don't hide restaurants when they have an infection. When you go to an inspection, you don't say, well, they had 50 more hot meals than other restaurants, so we're not going to tell you, or we'll bury it in the middle of a big table so you can't find it, which restaurant that was. I mean, it's not the way public health works.
So, Madam Chairs and Representative Greenlick, I will take that back to the program for their consideration. Again, there is an advisory.
For the fourth year in a row, you can take it back to them because I've been sending it to them every year.
There is an
advisory. So, I can expect over the next 6 years you can keep taking it back to them rather than doing anything about it.
I think what I was impressed with at least Mount Hood Medical Center, because this is a topic I always bring up when I visit them, and I think this was 5 years ago, and I think I was on the pulmonary unit. I can't even remember exactly which unit I was on. But I was so impressed. Those nurses, there was a group of them, and they wanted to decrease any acquired infections from their unit. I mean, they went down to their unit, and they tried all sorts of things. It ultimately came out that it was not changing pillowcases. And since there were a number of things, but those types of things, I feel if a unit at Mount Hood Medical Center, they found out that they share, and I think that's what's happening, do they share how they were able to combat acquired infections in their pulmonary unit? Yes, I agree with you, Representative Glenn, like we got to not necessarily say one institution is worse than the other, but focus on those that are really good and figure out what they're doing.
May I speak, Madam Chairs and Representative Greenlick? On November 1st, we are having a Partnership for Patients statewide meeting in Tualatin, and it is about celebrating superstars, those that have great stories to share, both with their improvement efforts, their safety efforts, and I would extend the invitation to any and all of you that would like to come hear about some of the bright spots that we have from Oregon hospitals.
Madam Chair and Representative Green, like if I might also add, this report, while it doesn't have one hospital compared to the other, what it does have is each hospital compared to the state, and then also what that standardized infection ratio is, so you can look at the state, and most of them is below. The other thing that it adds is confidence intervals. So again, I know this is a little wonky. Representative Green, like, knows this very well, but for the average consumer it might be, but the idea is that if 1 year you have two infections and the next you have four, it's doubled. On the other hand, it's only two infections. So so this kind of tells you how much that number, how sure you can be that it's actual, the real number. So again, the presentation does compare each hospital to what is seen around the state and to that national standardized infection ratio as a way that folks can compare at least their own hospital to how well that hospital is performing compared to the rest of the state or nationally.
What is your auditing system to make sure that the reports are done in a standard way and are being recorded accurately?
Chair Kenny Geyer, we don't have an auditing system per se. What we do is have a validation process. And so, again, what we do is to sample hospitals, and we go out and we review charts to see what's happening in the charts and what's happening with, for example, lab results and other things, and then compare those to what is in the NHSN system to see how well. And, again, at least in Oregon, that validation, while not 100%, you would never expect that. Sometimes there are infections that are not reported, and there are things that are reported as healthcare acquired infections that are probably not, the patient may have come in with them, for example. To meet this strict definition, the patient cannot have this infection. It has to be diagnosed or the symptom onset after 3 days in the hospital, because if they get it on the first day in the hospital, they probably got it in the community. So again, looking at those definitions, and overall we do very well, but it is costly to do that kind of validation, so we've had to get special funding to do it from the Centers for Disease Control.
Okay. No further questions. Thank you very much for coming. We really appreciate this information. Now, Karen Wheeler will have a presentation on the alcohol and drug treatment programs as she's coming up. We know that treatment is supposed to be a part of the CCOs, and we would love to have some information regarding how alcohol and drug is doing.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson, Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee. My name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the administrator for addiction services with the Addictions and Mental Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority. And I guess this is fantasy. I've never actually had a presentation before a committee before where I had a PowerPoint slide. So do I need to control the arrows? Okay. Oh, okay. Thank you, Courtney. So I was asked to provide an overview of the alcohol and drug treatment system. And honestly, I thought what I was putting together was rather boring. So I wanted to tell you more of a story about how the alcohol and drug treatment system began. And it started in the 1970s. There was an initial investment from the federal government, and then the beer and wine tax in the 70s was passed in Oregon that dedicated a portion of beer and wine to alcohol and drug prevention treatment at both the state and local levels. So that really kicked off our treatment system in Oregon. And a very limited amount of Medicaid was funding addiction treatment at that time. And I will weave in more of an emphasis on Medicaid because of the CCOs, actually. So in the 80s, we had significant growth in the population of people who accessed treatment because of our revised DUI laws. In the early 1980s, we revised those laws, and we required everybody, including first-time offenders who are typically under a diversion option, to be referred to and receive addiction treatment. And so that dramatically increased the numbers of people in our system. And I was actually a provider in the private sector at that time, and I can tell you in the small clinic that I worked in, it drastically increased the numbers of people that we were seeing. We saw that in the 80s we started focusing on professional standards because there really weren't any professional standards for addiction counselors, very few standards for programs. So we revised administrative rules and we started talking about counselor certification. In the 90s, we saw a tremendous amount of activity in the addiction treatment world. So this is where we set standards for counselor certification. And one of the certification boards that is currently in existence, the Addiction Counselor Certification Board of Oregon, who certifies about 2,500 to 3,000 counselors. And then we had several other boards at that time that have since sort of dropped away. So there are standards for counselors, and essentially they take a nationally recognized test that's validated and normed. It's taken around the country, whether or not the state has licensing or certification. It's the same test, essentially. We also implemented the American Society of Addiction Medicine placement, continued stay, and discharge criteria in the 90s. This was in the mid-90s when we were gearing up to really put the addiction benefit into the health plan, the outpatient benefit into the health plan. And we had fully capitated health plans at that time, and I think the conversation was, again, I was a provider until 96 when I came to the state, but I believe the conversation was, if we're going to fund addiction treatment, we want to make sure that the level of care is adequately evaluated. So we want to know that the person is in need of outpatient or intensive outpatient treatment and how long they need to stay there. We need to make sure there's some criteria set in place so that we are paying for a person who actually needs the service. So that's when we implemented ASAM. We call it ASAM. And we adopted that by rule into our administrative rules for all publicly funded addiction treatment programs. Again, in the 90s, we had the health plan expand by creating the standard program. And many people who came on to the standard program, and at that time we had open enrollment, people just called a 1-800 number, excuse me, and they actually got an application sent to them, or they went somewhere to a DHS office and completed the application, and the date they got enrolled was the call date. You know, it was dated back to the day they made the call. So the treatment program I worked in installed a phone in our waiting room so that people who were walking in who didn't have the Oregon Health Plan could just call right there, and we set up their assessment that very day or the very next day. There was no waiting time to get into treatment. So I really hope that that happens again in 2014 in January.
When did that end?
Did it end,
that program?
So Chair Kenny Geyer, Chair Mona Sanderson, representatives of the committee, the standard program was significantly reduced in the recession time of 2002-2003. Initially, it was cut off for 9 months, and I remember the day this happened like it was yesterday, because it was like the shoe just dropped, and there goes a big capacity in the addiction system. So that reduction, in addition to there were general fund cuts as well during 2002 and 2003, made about a $25 million reduction in the addiction system occur in that time frame. And we lost about 1,000 addiction counselors in the field at that time, and about 1,000 mental health counselors lost their jobs in the early 2000s.
Past decade.
Yes. So, and then since then, standard came back, but in a reduced capacity, without the open enrollment, but administered with a different enrollment framework. So, in the 90s, we saw the
standard's going away.
Oh, I'm sorry. Standard is going away in January.
We're going to the plus.
But the people will be eligible for the plan under the OHP 2014 population, adults who have incomes below 138% of the federal poverty level. So that particular population of adults, we anticipate a segment of that population will need addiction treatment. There's a segment that won't, that might be risky, have risky drinking or risky drug use. And we're putting some policies in place so that at primary care, at the primary care level, people get screened. Mm-hmm. So there's things like screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment, or ESPERT, as we call it. In fact, I came to another committee to ask permission to apply for a grant, found out we did not get it, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But we still have a lot of activities underway to implement ESPERT, and we'll be regrouping and figuring out how we can support the system in doing that. So, because we really need not just addiction treatment, not just specialty treatment, we need an army of people working in various levels in healthcare, including primary care, to screen for addiction problems and alcohol and drug problems, as well as other social settings. So I'm moving on, and I'm up to today. In the 2000s, right now, we have transitioned the residential treatment system that's funded by Medicaid over to the CCOs. That was effective July 1st this year. So the CCOs, unlike the fully capitated health plans, the CCOs now manage an array of addiction services with outpatient, intensive outpatient, residential, and detox. So, and also the people who need addiction treatment need health services. So we very much are excited about coordinated care and people accessing an array of healthcare services, including behavioral health services that are coordinated by the CCOs. So just a few details about the addiction system. There are 340 outpatient programs statewide. Some of these programs might be operated by the same agency, so programs are licensed site-specifically, so by address. There's at least one provider in every county geographic region of the state, and most of the tribes have alcohol and drug services, both prevention and treatment, funded by our office. We have 10 licensed freestanding detoxification programs statewide, and only 6 of those receive public funding currently. We have 65 licensed residential programs statewide, and only 40 of those are publicly funded. In 2012, just a little over 44,000 unduplicated individuals were served in the alcohol and drug treatment system. And they were served in the following settings. In residential, there were 4,432. Youth residential, it's a really small system. There's only about 61 beds for youth residential treatment, so 481 youth. And then we separate out non-DUI versus DUI because it is different. It's a different population. So non-DUI saw 23,000 people or over that, and then DUI services had 13,000 referrals.
Can I ask a question here?
Yes.
I just went to a DePaul luncheon last week, and I was hearing about, I think they said 1 in 8 youth are served, or maybe it was even a smaller percentage. Out of all of those, which is the one that is most underserved out of all those categories in terms of percentage of those who need it?
Yes. I didn't include this in my slides, but I do have a graph that we typically put in our Ways and Means document that has the prevalence and the number served and then the gap. So, and this is for publicly funded services. It's really hard to put an accurate, exact number because some people do have private health insurance and they access treatment that way, or they're not captured in our data system.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as youth are concerned, between ages 12 and 17, the estimated number of people who need services because they have a diagnosis of dependence mm-hmm. or abuse was 23,607. And that's according to the National Survey on Drug Use and Health that's conducted every year by SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. And the number of people served, as you see, is 4,000, just over 4,000 in the publicly funded system. So the estimate, the percent of need met was about 18%. So that leaves about 82% unmet.
Mm-hmm.
So that's about right.
That's about right. But 4,000, that says 481.
That's in residential.
Yeah,
youth residential. So in outpatient, there's a lot more youth that access that level. And then for 18 to 25-year-olds, the estimated need is 84,500. And we serve about 10,000 people in that age category. And then for 26 plus, the need is 209,800. So it's almost, you know, it's quite a lot. And we serve about 30,000 people in that. It's 26 and above. Okay, so speeding right along. I know everybody wants to get home. The next slide shows you the primary drug of choice, which I think is interesting. It's an interesting data point. So you see that the number of people who access treatment for alcohol as their primary drug of choice has gone down, whereas we see an increase in the number of people accessing treatment who are addicted to heroin. That's, I think, in the green line that you see there, that's going up, a little bit of uptick. Well, it's statistically significant. And then for amphetamine, methamphetamine, that also is ticked up a little bit, but that's remained relatively steady for a number of years. Oregon's had quite a history serving people with amphetamine dependence. Okay, so what we are planning to report with our partnerships with the Division of Medical Assistance Programs and the CCOs, since so much of the benefit now is managed by the CCOs, we believe that it's our responsibility to make sure that the system is still getting people into treatment. We want to make sure that it's stabilized and that people are still getting into the doors of treatment. So we're going to be reporting on eligibility for service and service use for people that are members of CCOs, the diagnosis and substance type for these members, the type of substance use disorder service that they access, by age, residence, and service plan, or CCO. And then we want to also be looking at screening and case finding, which I mentioned earlier in terms of the SBIRD activities, the diagnosis and assessment, brief interventions, detox, withdrawal, residential, outpatient, and other continuing care management kinds of services that aren't really provided to a scale that we'd like to see right now, which is more speaking of that continuum of care, which not only includes treatment, but recovery supports, peer-delivered services, coaching, and things like that after an individual accesses treatment, which can really nicely be done in a primary care setting. So I think that's all the slides I had. I'd be happy to answer any questions or be of service to you again in the future at any time.
As you know, the Alcohol and Drug Commission is starting up. It'll be interesting to see what direction that goes and if it can be... it had such momentum for a while, and then we lost everybody, except Bruce was still around, Bruce Goldberg. So do you have any comments regarding the Drug Commission? I know we're going to be meeting soon. I think I got an email on that.
Chair members of the committee. All I would say is I did meet the new director of the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission, and we had a wonderful chat. I plan to meet with him again, and I've told him that our division would be willing to help him in any way possible. I will be attending that meeting as well, and we will provide charts, graphs, information, testimony, input, whatever we can do to help.
I have a question on your primary drug of choice. Does that include prescription drugs?
Chair Kinney-Geyer, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, we are in the process of revising our data system. The answer is yes, but it's with a caveat. The way that we capture data, I should say that data system we use now is 30 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So the way we captured that data that we did 30 years ago has drastically changed over time, and we're in the process of implementing OWITS, which is a new data system that I hope to be showcasing for you in the next 2 years to come, having better data. Thank you.
So the question I have, given the big gap between the amount people served and those that need some level of service, so is there anything within that that prioritizes or gives people access? I mean, what decides other than money?
Chair Kinney-Geyer, Chair Mona Sanderson, Representative Lively, members of the committee. Yes, there are a set of priority standards for programs as they admit people. Pregnant women, IV drug users,
parents with dependent children, and then it's a sliding fee scale. People are not admitted based on their income. Actually, the people we want to see served in our publicly funded system are people that are the poorest or the least able to pay.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Greenlick, any other questions?
Well, thank you so very much. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If I see, thank you, committee, for being
here. Can I have one moment with my committee when you're done, Madam Chair?
Okay. And I would like to go ahead and adjourn the informational hearing for the Senate.
Thank you.
For the House Committee, you heard Chair Mama Sanderson talk about the fact that we have three committee bills possible. And we need to decide those at the next meeting. If there are members of the committee that are interested in nominating bills to be considered as committee bills, it would be very useful if you got up to Sandy and the vice chairs and me so we could have some advance notice on that, because we will decide by the end of the next meeting. Thank you, Madam Chair. You did a great job. I obviously wasn't missed.
Well, I was gonna say we will leave the last words for our chair in absentia and adjourn the meeting with that.
For the House Healthcare Committee. Adjourned.
Did you want to